open, we'll call this. Senate Health, Human Services, Rural Health will come to order. We're going to have a couple
of public hearings.
The first one is going to be on Senate Bill 1011. We're not going to move this bill today, but we are going to hear some testimony. A little bit later, we will have a work session on Senate Bill 991, which we will move, and Senate Bill 1005, which we will move. But we, to start with, we're going to discuss, because people are here for that, Senate Bill 1011. So Kathleen Bradley and Paul Cieslak, would you come up, please? And Katie, you may accompany them, because if anything goes wrong, I will blame it on you. So come up here and... Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while they're getting settled, I just want to bring to your attention Senate Bill 1011. You have a dash one amendment in your meeting packet. We have not received the fiscal or a revenue on this bill with that amendment at this time. So that would be what the holdup would be should in moving this bill should the committee decide to accept the dash one amendments.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I just want to say that we're a little bit late today getting started. We've had some caucus meetings and so on. We still have people who are not here, but we will proceed anyway. Who's up?
Kathleen? Chair Morstedt, thank you very much. My name is Kathleen Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. With me today is Dr. Paul Cieslak, who is the medical director for our immunization program, and we are here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1011 and to support the changes that are in the Dash 1 amendment. In the testimony that you have before you, I'll just hit a couple of the highlights because I think it's important to remember that influenza is a serious and easily spread disease. In a typical season, it affects 10 to 20% of the population, and combined with pneumonia, it is considered to be the eighth leading cause of death. In the United States, it is killing an estimated 36,000 Americans annually. In Oregon last year with the H1N1 flu, we saw over 1,300 Oregonians hospitalized and 66 die from influenza-related complications. Many people at high risk for complications are likely to visit healthcare providers in the outpatient setting as well as in hospital settings, and that really is the genesis behind this bill today. We think it's important for the safety of the consumer who visits these settings, for those clients that are hospitalized or seeing providers, and also for the direct healthcare providers themselves, that they actually are protected with flu, from the flu with vaccine. Since 1981, the Centers for Disease Control's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices has recommended annual flu vaccine for all healthcare providers. We do know that in Oregon, in 2008, barely half of our Oregon direct service providers received a flu vaccine. So only half of our providers are doing something that's been a standing best practice for well over 20 years. The authority supports this bill because we believe it makes explicit the expectation that healthcare providers should be vaccinated in order to keep patients safe and to prevent the spread of disease. We also believe this bill balances the need not only to protect vulnerable clients, but also individual choice. So providers still can opt out of vaccinations, but they have to do it intentionally. And it's that act of having to do something intentionally that we think raises the level, raises the bar of expectation around this. And that's what our experience suggests, is that many people intend to get a flu shot and they just don't get around to it. So we're making vaccination a default, and we believe this will increase the number of vaccination rates amongst providers. In the amendment that you have before you, the Dash 1, most of the issues that we have cited at the end of our testimony are addressed. What we had suggested is that there be an explicit date every year, December 31st, so that vaccination occurs prior to the flu season so that it's effective, that the Oregon Health Authority can develop rules to monitor compliance, that the health officer, the state health officer, can suspend the need for this in the rare occasion of vaccine shortage or less than rare occasion, as we often see. We also made the recommendation that all health care providers, licensed and unlicensed, who offer direct care be included, as well as providers who have privileges, and we support the continuation of no-cost vaccination. Dr. Cieslak and I are here and available for your questions, and thank you very much.
Maybe Dr. Cieslak will answer this, but those health care providers who, for instance, the CNAs, there was a recommendation that they be an amendment to include CNAs who are direct providers. Do we need an amendment to do that, or are they included automatically?
Chairman Morissette, I think that they're included under the current bill because the way that licensed healthcare professional was defined refers to ORS.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the communicable disease section for the health authority and also serve as the medical director of the immunization program.
Thank you.
I believe that the inclusion of CNAs do not. I'm sorry, I was thinking of EMTs. CNAs are not currently included in the bill. I think some amendments would be able to include them, or if we gave rulemaking authority to the health authority to determine who's in and who's out, I think that would allow us to zero in on those persons who provide direct patient care.
That would be rulemaking authority that you wouldn't have unless we specifically gave it to you in the bill. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay, so that would be rulemaking authority. Question.
Just a clarification. I'm sorry that I'm late, but I heard the word no cost, and I've never known if there's a free lunch anywhere. So who actually bears the cost?
Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, that actually is currently in the ORS, that for healthcare facilities that are providing vaccinations, they're at no cost to their employees, so the healthcare facilities carry the cost.
So the facility itself, so ultimately it gets passed on to the patients and everybody else, right? Yes.
If I could, Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, it's an excellent question, and you know, we've picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit in public health, but this is something that's still out there. It turns out that analyses have shown that it's actually cost savings. Influenza vaccine is very inexpensive, and when you look at the absenteeism from work that you avoid by vaccinating the workers, you'll actually save more in direct medical costs of those workers than you will expend on the vaccine.
That didn't answer my question. I wanted to know so the employer actually has to purchase the vaccine, and the cost then rests with the employer, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. What if we add an amendment that says if the employee has insurance, that the insurance company would then cover the cost like they normally do? Because I think everyone who works for a hospital has insurance from someone, and that way the cost is covered. So could we make and just say that if the employee does not have insurance, then the hospital or the employer would cover the cost if they don't have insurance? Could we say that? Of course we could.
Chair Morissette, of course you can. I think we'd probably want to maybe assess that a little bit further. I do believe that part of the interpretation of not being involved in billing third party is just the additional cost and paperwork, but we'd need to do a further assessment of that.
Now, wait a minute. Billing a third party.
Insurance.
That's why you have insurance. Somebody's got to bill the third party. I mean, when I go down to Bi-Mart to get my flu shot for $25, they have to bill the insurance company. And that happens all the time. That's why you have insurance. So I don't see that as... I mean, I'm not feeling sorry for the insurance companies right now who collect the big premiums because... Well, okay, the employer having to bill the insurance company...
Yeah. Chair Morissette, it's a fair question, but picture inside a hospital a cart with influenza vaccine going down the hallways vaccinating all the nurses and CNAs and physicians. They can buy the vaccine, which is $10 a dose, and vaccinate the people. I think you may find that it costs nearly as much to do the paperwork to get the money back from the insurance company as it does to do it themselves. I'm agnostic as to whether the insurance company is billed for this or not. We're just interested in the patient safety and getting the healthcare workers vaccinated.
That's in keeping with what a pharmaceutical rep told me one time, that the pills that they manufacture and sell are pennies per pill. The cost is very... Okay, so what you're saying is the actual... The cost to the employer, now, let me get this straight, you think would be about $10, whatever?
Yes, typically the cost of influenza vaccine is about $10. You know, I imagine the larger employers could get some deal by bargaining with the various flu vaccine manufacturers for quantities of vaccine. But it's I wonder whether it would be cost effective for them to go through the process of doing the billing.
Okay, that I appreciate that. Yeah, I was thinking your $25 cost, but then it doesn't cost him obviously the employer that. Okay. Question. Yes, Senator Verger.
Chair Morissette, I think that it also makes a statement about the hospital or the facility that they're interested in keeping all of their health care workers, and it's a service that's free and of no cost to them, and particularly if they can do it at a reasonable price. I think it would be worthwhile not to, even though I think your point is well taken, that it probably would cost more than that to go through all the hassle of everybody's insurance in doing it. The only thing that I want to be sure about is that for those people who simply do not want the vaccine, that there would not be any pressure applied or any difference made. In other words, if there's a station to be vaccinated, everybody that wants it gets it free, they go there. If you don't want it, you send in a note or a letter that says, I'm refusing to take this vaccine, so that you have something in writing. But as far as any pressure to, because you're a health care provider in that facility and have refused the vaccine, to be of any importance, I would not want that to happen.
Senator Verger, or Chair Morissette, Senator Verger. You know, I think it's a good point, and we have no intention, for example, of adding amendments or writing rules to make people wear masks if they don't get vaccinated, as I know has been done in some hospitals. I think what we want to do is simply make it absolutely clear that the default is that you get vaccinated unless you actively tell us that you don't want to get vaccinated. I do think that the declination form should be informative. It should be an informed declination that says, I understand that I'm at higher risk for influenza because I'm a healthcare worker, and where do sick people go? They go to healthcare workers, and that I may put my patients at risk if I get influenza. So I think those things should be on the declination form. But other than that, I would not be. We've talked about this, and we're not in favor of any sort of scarlet letter on the healthcare worker.
Okay, declination form. Now, what I have and what we've looked at before is the CDC form, but I think this bill would allow you to come up with the form. Is that correct? Okay.
Chair Morissette, yes, the health department would develop the form, and what we've talked about is having information so that we can have information about the reason for declination, so that we can get a request to have annual reports from the healthcare system that would give us total numbers of vaccinated, non-vaccinated, and aggregated information at that level.
Okay. Would the employer have to keep track of those forms, or would they simply send them to you to compile? Would they have access to a list in case a CNA or someone came from another employer, and so on? There's some pushback on the residential care facility keeping track of the forms and how long they have to keep them and so on. Have you thought about that?
Chair Morris said yes, at least a little bit. Obviously, it's the employers who have the information on who's working for them and who's seeing direct patient care. So we would need to rely on them to tell us who needs to be vaccinated and how many of them actually got vaccinated. We're mostly interested in aggregate data because I think I can envision you asking us to come back before the committee and tell you how it went and how many people got vaccinated in the wake of the law. So we want to be able to come back and say, you know, this percentage of physicians, this percentage of nurses, this percentage of CNAs got vaccinated in a given year. once they give us the data, I don't think we need to require that they keep data at all. We could maintain aggregate data and be able to draw the graph for you within the Oregon Health Authority.
And the names of the individuals who decline are not going to be, I mean, what will happen? Okay. The individual who signs the form, that form will be sent to you. No?
Chair Morissette, it's not the intent that we're actually, because there's not a fiscal cost to this in terms of maintaining a data system at the state. What we're asking is that the individual institution maintain the individual level data and that they are able to provide the data to the state when the state requests aggregated data. So the forms stay in the institution.
Okay.
And we would send a request. We will be writing this in rule. That rule is open to a public process for comment. We might recommend that people keep their records for several years, but Dr. Cieslak is correct. Once information has been reported to us, there wouldn't be a need to maintain it. And it's not about individual information. We're not interested in individual information on specifics. It's the aggregated data.
Just question. Oh, maybe somebody else.
Well, Senator Winters, and then
because I'm following up on your
okay, go ahead, question. And then Senator Telford, and then
let's say that I, you know, went to work for Dr. X, and he's keeping the data that I got my flu shot, but then I wasn't there a year. I went to another physician someplace, and they insisted also that I have another flu shot. Somehow, is that information going to be shared from one doctor's office to the other, or hospital to the other, or just how is that going to work?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, that's a good question. I think the way it would work is that the healthcare employee would be approached by his or her new employer and say, you need to get vaccinated or sign the declination, and the employee would have the option of either providing evidence of vaccination or of signing the declination again. So I imagine that that's the way it would have to work.
Keep that sticker that you got. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to put this in context. Catherine, you said that 51% of Oregon direct service providers already receive vaccination. So this bill is to put the hammer down on the 49% that for some reason don't get vaccinated. Do we have any, or do you have any data that says why these 49% who should be knowledgeable of the situation with them having direct patient contact, why they're not getting a flu shot?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, I'll briefly respond and then ask Dr. Cieslak too as well. That's actually not very well understood from my understanding, and that actually is one of the reasons why we want the declination form to be signed with some information on that that might begin to tell us. And it's not entirely the aggregate data that might be able to tell us is what percentage are religious objections, what are personal health objections, are there some other issues, so that we could then address it from a public health campaign perspective of what are the concerns we need to do. Dr. Cieslak?
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, I really don't know the reasons for the declinations. I suspect that they're all over the map. Some people are declining because they're afraid of needles. Believe it or not, even in the healthcare setting, I know that there are people like this, and other people are declining because they have objections or sometimes believe the rumors that you know the vaccine is ineffective.
So just follow up.
Yes.
So we don't really know why people aren't, but we're going to draft statute, state law that says whatever your reasons are, it's mandatory that you get vaccinated unless you sign. Seems a little overkill, but okay. Thanks for the explanation.
Okay. Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, it really is critically important that the spread of influenza is addressed. And we do have a significant concern that in our healthcare settings, which should be considered to be a very safe environment for patients to go to, that really almost 50% of providers don't do it. We do believe for many of them it's just simply good intent and not follow through. So if we have some additional ways of setting up mechanisms for doing that, the last hospital that I worked in prior to coming to work for the health department, I had to get off shift and go to a different hallway down to another building to get my shots, which meant I had to be attentive to it. There are other hospitals that use approaches such as Dr. Cieslak suggested of taking a cart and going down a floor in the middle of a shift, which would be an enormously easy way to make sure that people were vaccinated or that it was more available. So I think this places incentives in the healthcare setting for them to be a little more assertive around it. It also supports for employees that they actually do take advantage of it. And again, respects the rights for those who choose not to.
Yeah. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And based on that, I have a situation. I have a client who has more than 25 employees, and they provide IV services so that they are they do have direct patient contact, but they don't. They're not in a setting where they can have a cart come to them. So it does the bill say that these individuals then have to take time off their job to go get vaccinated wherever they can find a place, stand in line, et cetera, or is this done in their own time? Is this undone in the employer's time, off the job, out of production, or on personal time?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, thank you for the question. The intent is that it's actually provided by the employer, which is what many of our employers are currently doing. So it's considered, I do believe, to be job time. The setting that I suggested was in a hospital setting, which would be more traditional. Certainly in other office settings or settings where you've got employees that are out, the option may be that it's available for them when they are there for meetings. Which we see in home care settings, you know, where you have staff that are meeting there and then they go out to visit in the homes. I think there are a variety of different ways that that can be done. Less likely that I think the employee would be expected to go off-site.
Yes. If I may, Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, remember that there already is a statute on the books that says that for, you know, as a matter of worker safety, that the employers must offer the vaccine to at-risk healthcare workers. So I think that would continue to be in force.
Okay. Which leads me to raise the question that others have raised. How much authority do you currently have? You must offer it. You can't require it.
I don't...
Chair Morissette, the health authority doesn't have the authority to do this right now, but in existing statute, not in rule, but in statute 433.416, there is a mandate for employers to provide vaccinations for which the healthcare workers are at risk at no cost to the healthcare workers, and that same statute prohibits any healthcare employer from mandating a vaccine that isn't mandated by state or federal law.
Okay, and it can't be a condition of employment.
Right.
It cannot be a condition of employment. So what do you really need then to enforce your existing authority to offer? You can't mandate it, you can offer it. So you're offering it and you're giving them an opportunity to opt out is what it amounts to.
The employers are offering it and the current bill would say that the healthcare worker is required, that the healthcare employer must now not merely offer it, but must require it of the employees.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering, and we have other people who are going to testify from the industry, and I'm going to ask them if their employers that they represent actually offer this to their employees and what kind of response they get and how they can show that they actually offer it, that they're following the letter of the law to proactively offer, and what kind of response they're getting and what evidence they have that they are getting a response. Very good. Maybe that's what the bill should say. You should verify that they are offering it, offer evidence that they are offering it, and find out why people are not accepting it. Do you need a bill to do that?
Chair Morset, we feel that actually the way this bill is drafted, it will achieve those goals.
Well, but what if we don't get a bill? What can you do if we don't get a bill? Can you say the law says you must offer, demonstrate that you are offering, and demonstrate why people are not taking you up on it?
Chair Morset, I'd probably have to consult our Assistant Attorney General to see whether we have
well,
any authority.
Well, seriously, because that's what I'm hearing from people. Why do we need a bill to do something when the statute already says that you have the authority to require it? And maybe, so I'm going to be anxious to hear from those people who are sitting in the back row shaking their head.
But my response to your question is that, you know, we're at about 51% of vaccination, and the experience of others who have required either getting the vaccine or signing the declination form has been that vaccination rates go up in the wake of such a requirement. Moreover, the current statute prohibits healthcare employers from instituting their own mandates, which may be even more stringent. And if you had a bill saying that this was the default, then that would free up the employers in order to protect their patients to say our employees are going to be vaccinated. When you come into our hospital, you'll be.
What I would like to do before we come back on Thursday is to find out if you have the authority to require that employers do offer it to their employees, if they actually do. If you could set up a system to get that information, and then to add on if they don't. You're telling me that these people don't accept it. We want to know why they don't accept it, because we want to know for sure that you're actually offering. I mean, I'm just wondering if there isn't a way within the existing statute to do that. Other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Tom Holt and Dave Fiskum. And Jim Carlson. Oh, there you come. Okay, I just wanted to be sure Jim was going to be here. Now, you guys promised that you weren't going to oppose this, so just be careful what you say now. You're neutral, right?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt here on behalf of our Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We appreciate the focus that you brought to the issue of immunization of healthcare workers in healthcare facilities.
Well, the reason we do this is because the first rule of healthcare is do no harm. And if you operate a facility that is going to care for patients, you must pay attention to that. Do no harm.
We would completely agree with that.
Very good.
And we think it's very reasonable from a consumer standpoint that if you're coming to a hospital that you expect not to catch an infectious disease from the health professionals on staff. And so we work very hard to try and get people to accept their immunizations. And as you heard from Dr. Cieslak, it is current state law that, and has been since 1989, that we offer all immunizations to the staff, but we cannot require it as a condition of employment.
That's right.
So we're, you know, as the bill stands, we'll be neutral on the bill in an affirmative way. But on the dash one, I think there's just perhaps some technical issues that we can work out with public health related to how we would keep how we would deal with the forms. And we had some brief conversation just before the hearing. And we think those are probably resolvable. I think there is still an open question of, that it would be helpful to get the view of either LC or the AG of, you know, where does the statutory authority end for doing rules in this area, and what could be done under existing law. And if a bill is necessary, then we're okay with that. But we'd just like to get some clarity around that issue so that we can all work together to raise the immunization rates. What we hear anecdotally from among our members is the rates vary fairly widely. At some of the smaller facilities, they're quite high, around 90% is what I'm hearing anecdotally. But others are not as successful, and the rates are not nearly at that level. They're more around the 50s, and we would like all those rates to be starting with a 9 if we had our way. So with that, I'll close.
Okay, we do have LC representative here. Dave.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiscom here representing Providence Health and Services. As some of you know, we operate 8 hospitals in this state, spread throughout the state, and we have behavioral health programs, long-term care programs, children's care programs, and we have a total of in the range of 17,000 employees statewide. I just want to make a couple comments to you to buttress what Mr. Holt has said. I feel to a degree like I'm trapped between two of my friends, so maybe I can be fairly brief. We just have seen the Dash 1 amendments within the hour, and Mr. Holt is right. We have talked with the Health Division about them and have some questions about them, but generally I'd make 5 points to you. First of all, Mr. Chair, knowing this is your bill, we believe this is a good bill, a good issue to deal with. It's well-intentioned. It's designed to serve the public good. I think you should also assume that smart, competent, quality-oriented health care providers in this state want to encourage vaccinations. We, in fact, as Providence Health and Services, have encouraged all of our employees to be vaccinated, not just those who are licensed medical workers. Many of our employees who do not have a health care license of some kind do come in contact with patients or their loved ones, and so we emphasize the importance of all employees considering the option of the opportunity of vaccinations, and in fact, Providence does cover the cost of the vaccinations. A fourth point I'd make to you is our voluntary program is working well. Overall, we have achieved nearly a 60% vaccination rate on H1N1 with this voluntary program. Are we satisfied with that? No, we would like it to be higher. But in fact, in our hospital high-risk areas, we've achieved rates of between 70 and 100%, depending on the facility and depending on where it is and depending on the characteristics of the employees who do have an option to decline to be vaccinated on one or more bases. An obvious one is for medical reasons, and many times an employee's medical provider, a doctor, a nurse, a PA, will be opposed to vaccinations for medical reasons, and there also are religious reasons, moral reasons, if you will, that would allow somebody the option to decline to be vaccinated. We already do report to the state the percentage, the aggregate of our employees who are vaccinated and, in fact, who decline to be vaccinated. We are under, as hospitals, infectious issues as of the legislation last session, Mr. Chair. And so our concern with regard to the Dash 1 amendments is that we hope they don't add administrative burdens relative to record-keeping on special forms. We keep those records anyway, and we do report now aggregate numbers to the state. In conclusion, I guess I would just say in general that we support influenza vaccinations. I think our record is Providence Health and Services, and our colleague hospitals show that. We're not sure that a regulatory mandate, however, would strike the right balance, and we would encourage you to recognize the commitments that Oregon hospitals and other health care providers make in the area of vaccinations already, whatever you choose to do in your wisdom, Mr. Chair and committee members, with this bill. And we would be pleased to work with the Health Division over the next hours if there's a way to improve the Dash 1s to add clarity and precision.
Okay. Part of the purpose of this bill is to add some education that may not exist right now. If a person does decline right now, they just say, I don't want to do it, and they don't give a reason for it. Now, some people might decline because for various reasons that if, for instance, the CDC form goes down the list of things, they have to at least read that and then sign it and say, okay, I've read these, and I'm not going to do it. Now, in the state of Washington, I understand they have a bill that requires people who don't have the vaccine to wear a mask, and they have a long education process and so on. I don't think that bill has passed, but it's more, more of a burden, I guess, than what we're asking. And I see this bill as urging people to consider having the vaccine, where otherwise you just say, they can say, I don't want to talk about it. You know, at least this bill would give them pause to reflect. So now we, Elsie is here, Marissa James, and she will answer some questions if you have some specific questions.
Are you going to hear from Jim?
Jim. Of course we're going to hear from Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson representing Oregon Healthcare Association, and we represent about 580 licensed long-term care facilities across the state. First and foremost, I want to say that we strongly support as employers having a workforce that is vaccinated and trying to not only as employers make sure that our workforce is healthy and able to come to work and care for patients, but also to make sure we're providing the utmost protection and safety for those we serve. And so I think it's in an employer's own best interest to make sure that they've got not just on their licensed or certified staff, but I would say when you get into food service, you get into maintenance, you get across all your employees, and most of our members offer that far beyond licensed staff on the flu vaccinations and pay for that. I would actually say food service workers are critical in acute care, long-term care settings in addition to license. The question on whether CNAs are covered by the Dash 1s, I believe they are. If you look on lines 14 and 15 of the Dash 1 amendments under the capital sub B, it says an individual providing direct care to patients in a healthcare facility. So if you look up above, they do reference those who are licensed, but then on line 9 it says or, and then you then get down to lines 14 and 15, it says an individual providing direct care. So I believe that would be inclusive of CNAs since that question was raised. And my final comment would be, while we're very supportive of this and want to do as much as we can to educate and get higher vaccination rates, our primary concern would be to not have any kind of onerous paperwork tracking requirement where we would have to keep individual data for years and years. I think we're quite comfortable submitting aggregate data and getting that information off to public health. We'd be quite happy to submit individual data immediately to public health. I just don't believe we really want to maintain a lot of records for years and years on it.
I want to have Dr. Cieslak come up and be part of this discussion in terms of the kind of data that is going to be required. Jim, though, before you step back, in fact, you can stay. Dr. Cieslak, come on up.
The chairs are connected.
Oh, yeah, the chair. You have to move the whole row. How do you know your employers even talk about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now, in terms of on actual paperwork, there'd be very little paperwork there. I mean, we could go into cost reports and actually show expenditures for vaccines, which you would find. But, you know, short of that, I don't think you have a paper trail. And we're not averse to a paper trail. We're quite happy to have a reporting requirement. We just want to have that requirement and send, be it aggregate or individual data, we want to send it to public health and just not be responsible for maintaining
paper
records for years and years and years.
What if...
And we, Mr. Chair, if I might, and we also want to make sure we don't create some kind of pre-employment screening where we're obligated to offer vaccines outside of on an annual basis on seasonal flu vaccination. So if you're, for example, hiring somebody in, I don't know, June or July or something, certainly we're not averse to asking the question and everything else on seeing what their current status is, but we don't want to make it any kind of pre-employment requirement.
Okay. What if the department required you to verify that your facility, one of the facilities that you represent, must actually verify that they've offered this? Because I'm wondering if this thing isn't even, if just ignored, you know.
Mr. Chair, we'd have no objection to having an annual reporting requirement or something with a report that we would submit to public health indicating that this has been offered and sharing whether they want aggregated or individual data and submitting that on an annual basis.
Okay, Dr.
Mr. Chair, could I just add quickly while the doctor comes up, if he does, from a Providence perspective, this is a high-level corporate executive commitment, I attest to you. If that sounds like trust me, I don't mean that in the worst sense. I mean in the best sense. This vaccinations is a corporate commitment that Providence and other hospitals I know makes.
throughout the system of the hospitals and long-term care facilities and children's facilities and behavioral health facilities we operate in this state. And what we, I would just add that I share Mr. Carlson's concern, and I don't think you want to go to this spot, and I don't believe the Health Division does either, which is we're concerned about sharing individual data that mm-hmm. can be identifiable to an employee, because one of the important principles that we also have is to recognize the prerogatives of our employees to make their own judgments about what they do and don't do relative to medical, religious, and personal privacy reasons. And it's important to say that for the record, not because I thought you or the Health Division folks were going to head there, but that's what underlines for us what we already now do, at least I've been told we do, which is make aggregate reports on a periodic basis about vaccination rate progress as we seek to get toward 100%, but we know in total we'll never get there.
Okay. You are operating a very large facility. You have 9 hospitals and so on and so forth. What about the independent assisted living facility, for instance, or a nursing home and so on? How do we know that they are even aware of this requirement?
Yeah, I would just say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on an annual basis, particularly with the population that we serve, there's high degree of awareness of flu season. From an employer perspective, it's in their own self-interest to want to vaccinate and make sure that they're not going to be dealing with serious workforce shortages or anything else caused by, you know, flu epidemic. We spent tremendous amounts of time this past year talking, as we do every year, and we work generally hand in glove with public health about availability of flu vaccines. Generally, the population we serve is one of the targeted populations to make sure if there is a shortage that we're getting first allocations. And so we've worked historically for years and years with public health to assure that. And there is a high degree of awareness and education that already occurs on an ongoing regular basis around flu seasons.
Okay. Dr. Seesmer. Do you have any evidence that individual nursing homes and healthcare facilities are doing this?
Chair Morissette, no. I don't know what efforts are undertaken. You know, we have the law that says that they have to offer the vaccines. I can imagine the word offer being fulfilled in a variety of different ways, everything from posting a sign on the door that says don't forget to get your flu vaccine to, you know, coming up to them with the needle and saying, I've got it here, will you take it? And I suspect there's a variety of ways, you know, and a variety of degrees of aggressiveness in which the vaccine is offered. The only thing I can fall back on is the survey data that we have that say that 51% of the people get it.
Yeah, Senator Winters.
Just a question. Given that, in listening to Mr. Fiskum's testimony, where there is aggregated data and that is being sent in somewhere, that suggests to me that data can be collected and without a statute and sent somewhere. That same data that is being collected by Providence, through rule can also be collected by the long-term care facilities. I think the question is, and I had the same question, is actually legislation necessary for what you can do administratively? As I sit here and listen to testimony, Providence is already doing aggregate data. They know how many vaccines that they give, and they share that data someplace in the aggregate. They don't share names and what have you. I hear from Mr. Carlson that, you know, their concern would be added paperwork, and also not to have individual information shared, but the fact that you could actually aggregate the data, I don't hear any real concern. So I'm sitting here wondering if everybody can actually provide the information.
But are they? Is the question. And that's what I'm wondering is that, you know,
Senator Morissette, if I may, had the opportunity just last week to meet with our small rural committee, for example, and everyone had examples of how they provide vaccines offer declination forms and so on. So that there are, I mean, I would agree there are probably varying degrees of how aggressive people are. As it's a learning process to figure out, you know, what the magic words are to get people to accept the vaccine if they're skeptical of vaccines in general. People also may have good reasons to decline for medical reasons. But my sense is that, you know, hospitals are, you know, doing as best they can to make real offers of vaccinations, and you know, we would like the rates, you know, we would all like the rates to be better than what they are. And we hope to be able to work with Dr. Cieslak and others in public health to educate the workforce in such a way that we improve those rates.
Okay. Do you have a list of all of the employers who would be impacted or are impacted by this, by the existing law, the small ambulance companies, who these, you know, people are and so on, employers?
Chair Morrison, no, I don't have such a list. I actually didn't know about this existing law until you dropped this bill and we had to start looking into it.
Okay. Well, and this is a fiscal kind of thing, too. I mean, you know, if we had a bill that says you shall go out and contact all of these people, that would be a fiscal impact on you. And I'm wondering, you know, and so we're going through an education process here. I'd like to hear from Marissa.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I guess before I chase everyone away, what were the questions that were raised about the bill that prompted you to be here?
Me?
Yeah.
You what?
The existing authority.
Yeah, so I'm Marissa James from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And from what I understand, the question was how this existing law works with the bill that we have.
Right. Thank you. Yeah.
Right.
Because the reason that I said what I did earlier is because there was specific questions that were raised by various people that I talked with that prompted us to invite you here. But I think you're going to be covering those things. So why don't you go ahead and discuss how the bill affects existing law.
Okay. Chair Morissette, the existing law we have, I think there's a couple reasons why this bill may be necessary to accomplish what you want to accomplish. First, as we've discussed, the existing law doesn't require workers to be immunized, whereas the bill does. So we've discussed that issue. And from what I can tell, there's no penalty there's no specific penalty, at least, if an employer does not offer the immunization that's required by 433 and 416. There's no specific penalty that the authority can impose. There may be some kind of general penalty, you know, that can be imposed for a violation of a rule of the department, but there's no specific penalty in this law. So the bill has a little more teeth, maybe. It doesn't have a penalty either, but it does have the requirement rather than just the offering. And then also, in looking at it myself, infectious disease isn't defined, and it seems like everybody assumes that seasonal influenza qualifies as an infectious disease, but from the language of the law, it seems like maybe this law was targeted at things more seriously than influenza because, for example, it requires the health department, if it learns of a case of infectious disease, to notify the employee of the exposure. I doubt that any public health departments are notifying employees of seasonal influenza exposure. So I think that at least it would be good to, you know, have this bill or amend this law to specifically mention seasonal influenza so that you make sure that that's covered by the law.
But if we just say seasonal influenza, that doesn't include the special kinds of influenza that are not seasonal, like H1N1. That is not a seasonal. So should we just say influenza?
That's up to you. That's my understanding, it would be
more inclusive because it wouldn't require, if we said seasonal, it wouldn't require H1N1. So, okay. Did you have a response?
Chair Morissette, yeah, I just wanted to make the point that our vaccination rates, I think everybody is agreeing, are suboptimal. And this occurs in the face of nearly 30 years of recommendations from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices regarding vaccination of healthcare workers and 10 years of ORS 433.416, which mandates that the vaccines be offered to people. So we can do better than that, and there is a qualitative difference in statute that would be that this law would bring about, which is that instead of saying that the vaccine must be offered, it would say that employees have to get the vaccine. Now, there's an out. They can sign the declination form, but there's a qualitative difference there.
Yeah.
And in other areas where this has been looked at, it's been followed by increases in immunization rates. So, basically there are data attesting to its efficacy. And that's why we support it.
Thank you. Catherine, did you? Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry. Senator Telfer wants to say something, but let me finish this thought. So what you're saying then is that this bill would improve the existing law to the point where people would have to be offered and they could refuse. There's a difference. I mean, that would make sure that they were offered the vaccine, but they could still refuse. Now, as far as collecting data, again, what kind of data would you need? You want the aggregate.
Chair Morissette, I think this is something that we could hammer out in a rulemaking process, getting the various parties to the table.
Okay.
But I think what we would all be interested in would be to know how many employees you got in these various categories, what percentage of them got vaccinated, what percentage of each of those refused. And
okay.
We would aggregate them at the state level and be able to come back and tell
now,
you.
Now, the other thing that we covered, and I don't know if Senator Winters was in the room when you mentioned the cost of the vaccine to the facility would be how much? Minimal.
It's typically about $10.
Yeah, okay. So it isn't a huge cost. And the facilities who are already doing it are paying the cost of the vaccine. Is that correct for the most part?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Senator Telfer and Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, ORS 433. et cetera, is a voluntary, more or less. This bill makes it mandatory. Given that, I guess for LC's feedback, does the fact that we now mandate flu shot, so to speak, does that increase the liability risk exposure for somebody who doesn't get it? They sign, I don't want to get it, I don't like needles, or for whatever legitimate reason, they don't get one. Is there additional liability exposure for somebody, a patient that does get the flu?
Well, that's a theory for a trial lawyer, but I did have that thought when somebody mentioned that, you know, maybe the form would say, you know, you may be putting your patients at risk by not getting the flu, and I thought, I wonder if that could be a basis for a lawsuit. You know, that's probably a theory that a trial lawyer will try someday. I don't know if it would be successful or not, but that's a good question.
Okay.
Senator Williams.
You triggered in my mind when you said the existing statute does not have any penalty for violation. And if you add the new statute, does that then open the door for under rule to actually issue penalties? And I mean, right now we're talking about a voluntary system or a system even though it's required. My little brain said when you said penalty, does that then give the agency the authority to actually wage?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, I think that the agency would have the same ability to issue penalties for a violation of each.
With or without standards being set. Because now we're talking about supposedly collecting data in order to determine its usage whether we've gone from 51% to 60%. So in order to issue penalties on an entity or an institution, someone would have to set some kind of bar of saying that you haven't reached this particular level, therefore you're going to have a $1,000 penalty. That poses another, to me, that puts it in a whole different realm.
Sure, Morissette, Senator Winters, I don't think that the agency would have the authority to issue that kind of penalty, but set a quota for the percentage.
So would you explain the penalty statement that you made then?
Okay, so there is no specific penalty for either the existing statute or the bill. There may be, the department may have some kind of general penalty authority, but to issue a penalty for violation of a rule of the authority. But based on the language in the bill, the authority could not set a quota of vaccinations because the individual people have the opportunity to decline. The facilities would have no control over that. So I don't believe that there would be the authority to issue a penalty based on a quota of percentage of vaccinations.
On what basis would a penalty be issued?
If the facility did not offer the vaccine.
That's under the existing law. Yeah.
And I don't know if there is a general penalty like that.
See, this is what I was getting at, is under the existing law, do you have the authority to say you must verify that you at least offer the vaccine? I mean, can you do that under the existing law?
Chair Moore said, I just don't know. I'd have to consult with our attorney.
Because the law says they shall offer the vaccine. Well, how do we know they're offering the vaccine? And so that's something that I would like to get a handle on. We're going to hear the bill again on Thursday, but I'd like to see if you have that authority to require that people verify that they're doing what the law already says they have to do. And that's the crux of the question right now.
Chair Morrison, I can take a look at that too. So
oh, okay.
If you'd like.
Okay. Any other questions? This has been a great discussion. Anyway, thank you very much. And you're all going to be back on Wednesday, Thursday, right? Okay. And from what I understand, we don't need to include specifically CNAs because line 14 says an individual providing direct care to patients in a health care facility.
And she agrees with that.
Yeah, so that takes care of that amendment. Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1011, and we are going to open a work session. Let's see, is that the one that Sasha's here for?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 991.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had our public hearing on this bill last Thursday. You'll recall we heard from the Catholic Community Services. Senate Bill 991 is creating, what it's creating is an environment to exempt providers of certain parental respite services from regulation by the Department of Human Services, and it makes the providers of those parental respite services mandatory child abuse reporters. This has an emergency clause effective on passage, and you'll recall this is called Safe Families for Children, and we heard from folks from Illinois. And Sasha Sarah walked the committee through the amendments.
We haven't heard from Mickey Cerise yet. Good. Would you come up, please? Because I have some specific questions for you. Okay. Sasha, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senate President Courtney's office. I wanted to walk you through some amendments and give you some options. There are two amendments that do kind of similar things, but I had them both drafted. I wasn't sure where the committee wanted to go, and they're both dealing with kind of background checks and safety regarding the families, the volunteer families that would be taking children in moments of crisis from their biological parents, with the parents, as you will recall, retaining full custody of the children. So the three amendments that I have in front of you today, I believe, are the dash threes, the dash fours, and the dash fives. The dash threes change the...
hold it.
I don't have
it.
I have two, three, and five.
I have two, three, and five.
Well,
I have one, two, and three.
Oh, you just got five today.
Yes.
The five you got today.
But there's no four.
Okay.
I can.
We can
get fours. So I can walk you through them while we're getting you copies. The dash ones and the dash twos are kind of irrelevant at this point. The dash ones are incorporated into the dash threes. What the dash threes do is, instead of having everyone involved, including the volunteer families, be mandatory reporters, which causes some issues, we have the staff of the organization that is arranging the respite care. Those folks who are doing the home visits and things like that, they would be the mandatory reporters. For the most part, organizations that would be setting up this type of program, they already are mandatory reporters. We wanted to make sure that any new program that was begun in to do this, they would also be mandatory reporters. So that's the dash threes. The dash fours, or maybe I should go to the dash fives since you guys have those in front of you, and we'll get to the dash fours. They're kind of along the same lines. The dash fours is a little bit less stringent of a requirement in terms of background checks. The dash fives only require the private agency to conduct a criminal background check on all staff and volunteers of the private agency or organization and on all persons providing respite services under this act. So that would simply be a criminal background check, and they would do that, and we wanted to maybe Mr. Cerise here can talk about who would be doing that. It would be at the cost of the organization, not at the cost of the agency who was producing the background check, and it would be probably the state police who would be performing that background check, as they do for lots of folks. So that's the dash five. The dash fours are kind of along the same lines, but they require a memorandum of understanding, a kind of compact between the organization and the central background registry through the child care division of the employment department, so that in addition to the background check, this is similar to what Metropolitan Service Districts, I believe, did last year in a bill. In addition to the criminal records check, they also did a Child Protective Services records check within the Department of Human Services. And the amendment specifies that the child care division of the Employment Department would be fully compensated for that cost by the agency, by the organization, excuse me.
Okay.
So. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On the dash fours, it says in line 7, all subject individuals shall apply to be enrolled in the central background registry established by the division. This is a registry that's not established now, or is it?
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, it is my understanding, and we do have folks from the division here today who can better answer those questions, that yes, that is currently established. And we may want to change, we would like to change that language if you did decide to go with the dash fours. They just should be enrolled in it. It was an implication that they should be in the process of becoming enrolled as potential future care providers through this respite service. But we don't want them to just be applicants. We want them to actually have become enrolled in that.
Other questions?
Well, yes. Just to follow up, I'm not sure. I would like to clarify, maybe for Mr. Cerise, is there a background registry in your shop?
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson. No, this is referring to the child care division.
Right.
Oh, the child care division.
Yes, ma'am.
Employment. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Okay. Senator Verger and then Senator...
Yeah, I guess mine was just a point of clarification. It's like a clearinghouse. And I think that I just can't emphasize enough how important that is. And I think it's very wise to have as many checks and balances. After all, you're putting children in places that without constant supervision. And I guess my only question is, why did you need the dash fives? Why wouldn't the dash fours have covered a criminal background check?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, they absolutely do. The dash fives were submitted as an alternate to the dash four. They are a less stringent background check, and I wasn't sure which way the committee was going to want to go with it.
Oh.
So absolutely, the dash fives and the dash fours are totally separate, and I would encourage you to pass one but not both of them. The dash fours do have a background check, criminal background check, in them as well.
Okay. I'm glad that I had that clarification, Mr. Chair, because I really believe that the dash fours are an excellent clearinghouse.
Okay. Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having just received dash four, a point of clarification, and it's six pages and five is one page. So does five incorporate anything from the dash four, or are they totally separate?
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, they are totally separate.
Okay.
There is the aspect of a criminal background check in both.
I have a question.
Yes,
the difference between Senator
Wood.
Six.
I'm going to get to dash fours. What's the fiscal impact, or what would it cost the organization to do that dash fours versus dash fives?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, you're asking the cost to the organization, not the cost to the state.
Because as I understand it, that the organization will bear all of the cost. Mm-hmm. Am I not correct?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, you are correct.
And one will require, the registry requires a lot more involvement than the criminal background check by the state police. So can you kind of give me some kind of ballpark of, has an estimate been done of what this will cost?
Senator Winters, I am not able to give you that ballpark figure, but I believe there are some folks in the audience who can, if you would allow them to approach and talk.
No, come on. We're not dealing with dash one, two, and three.
Chair Morissette, we are dealing with the dash threes,
right,
but not the dash ones and the dash twos.
Oh, okay. We're going to deal with
the dash three was the change in the mandatory reporter from the volunteer caregivers to just the staff of the organization.
Okay, so we are dealing with the dash threes and either the fours or the fives.
Chair Morissette, yes.
Okay, right. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the legal and compliance manager with the Child Care Division. In answer to your question, Senator Winters, about we did a fiscal impact statement, it's a little difficult to pin down exact cost because in speaking with the agency that might potentially be administering this, they weren't entirely certain how many people would be participating and applying to enroll in the registry. Based on their tentative figures of approximately 50 host families participating in this, and depending on how the bill is interpreted, whether it would mean how many people in that household would go through the background check, we estimated approximately $12,000 about for the 2009-2011 biennium and $19,260 for the biennium 2011-2013. The cost is, I'll just explain a little bit further. We had to do an estimate of the cost when the Metro Service District approached the legislature about having us do their background checks. It's about, on average, $50 to $70 is the cost for doing the background check, and that does not include fingerprinting. If there is any kind of background that shows up and or the person has lived outside the state in the last 18 months, then they have to be fingerprinted under our registry rules, and that's an additional, that is a state police cost of $62. That's a pass-through, not something that, you know, that's just something that we pass through. There are limitations to our background check. We operate in a structure of regulated child care, and again, depending on how the legislation is interpreted, the way we conduct background checks for regulated child care, which is care of children for part of a day, not a situation like this where children would be in care for a long period of time. So our background checks are geared to those situations where children are in care for part of a day and their parents are picking them up every day and checking in. But we do background checks under our regulatory system for child care not only on any adult in the home. That would be the person who wanted to be a licensed child care provider, their spouse, any child 18 or over, anyone who is a frequent visitor to the home, anyone who may have unsupervised contact with the children. It doesn't look like this legislation anticipates that in these homes, so it's, again, it's not entirely clear what the universe of people would be that would be undergoing these checks. And, you know, like I said, we do have some concerns, and we want you to be aware of the limitations of the checks that we do, because it is a structure that's set up background check set up to work in tangent in conjunction with our regulatory system, where we're going in and regulating the facility and checking on it on a regular basis, and they're subject to our facility rules. So I just want you to be real clear and understand that that's the kind of background check we do. It is not a background check that was set up for a program that takes children for long periods of time, like, you know, that's more in line with a foster care type setup.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I really would like to know what the program in, where was it?
Illinois.
Since they've already muddied the waters with dealing with this problem, how they did, because I think we could learn from them. It would be nice if we had them get a statement from them on how they deal with background checks and the cost. Because I think it's important to have feedback from the organization, because at least startup, 12,000, that's not serving kids, safety.
I understood that there was going to be $50,000 raised at the very beginning of this process to take care of costs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that meant to take care of background check costs?
Chair Morissette, yes. The expectation is that most of the startup costs will be kind of getting things off the ground, but Catholic Community Services, the organization that is doing the pilot program, already has, you know, a lot of organizational structure and staff that would be doing the same thing that they're currently doing: home studies, outreach,
okay,
you know, background checks. They do all of these things currently when dealing with foster care, foster homes, and other kind of social services aspects of child care. This would be very similar to what they're already doing.
Okay, so there is, I'm looking at the impact statement, and we don't have either a minimal expenditure impact, no expenditure impact.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've already requested a fiscal and revenue impact on all of the amendments before you. There's a minimal expenditure impact issued on the Dash 4 amendments, and there's a no expenditure
On
the Dash 3s.
Well, to us, but I'm talking about to the organization.
Oh, and no, but I'm just...
Five. Yeah, okay. Let's go back to your question.
Just a point of clarification. Since the organization, Catholic Charities, in their work already with the department, they do screenings, they do background checks, they do all of this anyway. So the addition of the Dash 5s, which actually just provides for the criminal checks, then why would we need, and I'm looking at Nikki, the 4s? Because this organization, it's not as though we're talking about dealing with an organization that's brand new. Historically, they have been doing business with the state and Children's Services. They were doing it when I was there in the 70s. So kind of help me why we would need to add a piece only. Just help me understand that.
Thank you. And Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, let me lead in, and then I'll let Sasha kind of give some details on this. But in our testimony, you may recall that we spent a great deal of time keeping the state government, out of this program. So everything that you described, Senator Winters, very accurately would not overlay in this program, because this is a different program.
Chair
Morris. However, you are going to and maybe there's not a fiscal on this, but you're going to be recommending which people go to the program. You have some oversight.
Chair Morissette, no. We have no oversight over the program.
You don't recommend who goes and who doesn't go?
No. We may, as an agency, make referrals to the program.
Oh, excuse me. Because I asked this question earlier, maybe I ask it to the president, about what oversight, how do you keep sending them to the wrong family? Someone's going to have to decide who goes where. Do you decide that?
That's the parents will make that decision.
Pardon me?
The parents.
Oh, the parent will make the decision of to which family their child will go.
Chair Morissette, in conjunction with Catholic Community Services, yes.
Oh.
Yes.
In conjunction with Catholic Community Services.
Yes. Catholic Community Services will offer up a family for a biological parent, and the parent has the final say on whether or not their child gets placed with that family.
Oh, okay. That clarifies that.
I would still like your wisdom. Since we're looking at two dashes, 2-4 and 5, and I'm trying to sort in my mind why we would need the 4s. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't the 5s, you know, given if I had an organization that didn't have a track record, I would say, yes, I would need the 4s. But I'm looking at an organization that probably is older than some people sitting in that audience and who have been doing this for so long and so many years. So that's why I'm begging this question. And so I'm looking for the professional that's sitting there in front of me to say, in your wisdom, would the dash 5 suffice with what we would need to get accomplished by getting the criminal background checks?
Chair Morissette, I don't mean to steal Mr. Cerise's thunder, but at this juncture, we are absolutely dealing with a very reputable, very trustworthy organization. This legislation opens the door for any organization to set up this type of program anywhere in the state.
Okay.
So we wanted to put in some
firewall.
A floor under which we've had confidence that no one that would have, you know, malicious or intent to harm these children, or if a small organization got in over their heads and wasn't able to do some sort of background checks or home visits, they would have a backstop, that because the state is in some ways authorizing a program like this to go ahead.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Monis Anderson?
On page 3 of the dash 4s, section 8, lines 18 through 27. I don't really understand what that piece is, and then the very last sentence on line 26 says, any monies collected under this paragraph shall be deposited in the child care fund. And I was thinking the state has. Can you explain what that section means? I tried to read it, but I still don't understand it.
Chair Morissette, Senator Anderson, or Mons Anderson, that is language that was derived from language that was used in prior legislation when the legislature determined that the Child Care Division ought to do background checks for the Metropolitan Service District. And so any funds that come into the Child Care Division get deposited in the state child care fund, and it is used for child care related services. It's not used for direct state agency. It's used for improving the quality and safety of child care in the state of Oregon.
So it just doesn't seem like this is relevant to this, and it's bold. It's brand new language. Mm-hmm. Is relevant at all to safe families?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mons Anderson, I believe the idea is because, and we weren't part of this amendment, so I don't want to, I'm neutral, not promoting it one way or the other, but I think the idea behind it was that because a child care division would be providing this service for what is essentially a type of foster care program, that the money would come into the child care fund.
At this point, would your agency be the one to do the background checks then? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mons Anderson, the Dash 4 amendments designate the Child Care Division of the Oregon Employment Department to do the background checks for this Safe Haven program.
Okay, now yes. I'm starting to understand. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Okay. Any other questions? You would prefer the Dash 4s for the reasons that you mentioned, that this is going to be open to other organizations around the state, and even though Catholic Community Services has a great track record, the Dash 5s might serve their, you know, purpose.
Chair Morissette, I think that our office would feel comfortable with either the Dash 5s or the Dash 4s. The Dash 4, as you say, is a little bit stronger. It's a little bit more of a safety net in terms of these organizations. But we are walking a fine line, okay. trying to kind of encourage a program that the state is not involved with, but also okay. allow for sufficient.
So we have the Dash 4s, and then we're going to also do the 3s.
I just need one more clarification
yeah, sure.
on page 5, starting with line 18, and we're starting to talk about executive power of attorney. And again, the language is attorney language, so I need to know why we're talking about power of attorney here.
Chair Morissette, Senator Montes Anderson, that stems from the original Safe Families Bill. What we have used to set up the care and control of the child, moving that from the parent, the biological parent, to the safe family, is a power of attorney. In current statute, it allows for care and control to be switched over to the safe family, but not custody.
Gotcha.
So that stems from that original bill.
Thank you.
And it's in the Dash 3s as well. Yes.
Okay. Do we want to other questions? Do we want to deal with the Dash 3s first and then deal with the Dash 4s? Any questions about the Dash 3s? Okay. We're in a work session.
Yes, we are.
No, are we in a work session? We are in a work session.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are in a work session. Okay. So we need an amendment, a motion for Dash 3s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment dated February 3rd, 2010 to Senate Bill 991.
Okay, Senator Telfer moves the Dash 3 amendments dated February 3rd, 2001. Any discussion? Any disagreement? Okay, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment dated February 5th, 2010 to Senate Bill 991.
Okay. Senator Telfer moves the Dash 5s dated...
No, 4s.
4s, I'm sorry. Dated 2005... No.
Dated February 5th,
2010. Okay. Any discussion? No disagreement. So ordered. Okay, we're moving right along.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 99.
Wait. It's either 4s or 5s, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So we're done.
We did the 4s. Right?
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
I move Senate Bill 991 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Tupper moves... Senate Bill 991 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Melissa Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Vice Chair Topper?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Okay. Carry will be President Courtney. Senator Courtney will carry the bill. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we have one more bill to deal with, and that is I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1005. We do have an amendment to 1005. Would you like to come up and tell us about it? Okay, this is...
Yeah, that's the emergency call.
Okay. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Marla Neal. I'm the Division Administrator for the Asset Property Management Division of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. What's the purpose of this amendment?
The purpose of this amendment is to allow the emergency clause for us putting this into effect immediately upon its passing, which will allow us to meet all of our required deadlines as we know of them today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I suggested that you do this.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this then allows them to act relatively soon if opportunity provides them to apply and fulfill or to apply for contracts and so
that's,
on.
That's correct.
Do we have discussion on the dash one amendments? Okay. Yes, Senator Telfer.
What is the emergency?
Well, the emergency, as we talked about before, because of the deadline of the contract, what we believe the deadline of the contract that may be coming, the request for proposal that may be coming from HUD, would put us beginning the work January 1st of 2011. It also would provide us the ability, with once you have gone back to your jurisdictions, will allow us to continue to move forward with bidding on the project. At this point, the deadlines are rather fluid. We are expecting this contract, the request for proposal, to come in any time. But this would allow us, whenever the contract request comes in, we'll be able to apply for the, we would be able to apply for contracts not only for our state, which is what we are most concerned about, is that we are able to bid on our own state. We do have that ability now, but if we would decide that we wanted to bid on another state, we would be able to do that.
Okay.
It also would allow us to do any work that we're asked to do within the state of Oregon that currently we're not able to get reimbursed for. For instance, we have professional property management firms that will come to us and ask us for technical assistance. Now, we do technical assistance to a certain degree for those people, for those projects that we financed. But, frankly, we expect if a property management firm is going to manage a property, they should be able to have the expertise to do that. But if they ask us to come in and do some trainings, at this point, we're not able to do that, to ask for any kind of compensation so that we're reimbursed for that period of time that we're training.
Follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the emergency is because there's some contract coming out. My understanding is that the contract is kind of in flux because HUD's not quite sure what they're going to do, whether they're going to do a regional one contract for a regional such as, now tell me if I'm wrong, that the state of Washington under that would be doing the compliance in Oregon. So what we're doing is competing with other states to do the region.
Yes. Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, that's exactly right. Currently, each state does their own contract. With HUD not yet telling us, it sounds like they're moving into the realm of allowing us to continue to bid on each state individually. However, if they come to us and say, in order to do your state, you must also do other states within your region or in the area, we do not have the ability to do that. Therefore, it puts us at an unfair advantage against someone like Bremerton Housing Authority, for instance, is a public housing agency that has the Washington State contract for compliance. They do not only Washington State, but they have been allowed to do several other states as well. And so it really puts us at an unfair advantage because, frankly, we don't have the ability at this point to bid on anything but our own state. And you're right. We still don't know. We're in that period of time where we don't have the request for proposal, and we don't know for sure yet if they're going to require you to bid on more than one state or not.
Our committee administrator has a further explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may recall at the hearing last week, Senator Winters brought up the subject of the Ways and Means timeline and the expectation of what the agency had to approach Ways and Means about in a timely fashion, even as far as getting permission and then acceptance, et cetera, et cetera. So it was during that discussion that we were given direction to go ahead and add an emergency clause as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
For the record, I also had requested information to assure that the agency was the only entity that would be able in Oregon to actually apply for those contracts. And the question was whether private or public. And so they did bring me the information that HUD contracts only with another public entity. Just I needed to clarify that since that was on the record.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion. Yes, Senator.
I just want to clarify just a couple of things. One is that the thought is that regionalization is going to be an improvement. Is that right?
That is. I understand that,
that's
Senator
what
Berger,
they think.
That they
anyway,
believe that is the case.
That they
yes.
think they're going to something that's going to be better.
Yes.
And the other thing is for you, in order to bid on other states, that's important where you can make up some lost funds or add to your revenue by doing that. Is that correct?
Senator Morissette, Senator Berger, that's exactly right. And our, quite frankly, our agency is not nearly as well off as we used to be because we're a bonding agency. We have a very, very small amount of general fund at this time, but our bonds are being paid off as that's what they're made to do.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the housing crisis, we've not been able to enter into any new bond indentures, which also furthers the complication for the agency. And matter of fact, last Friday, I took part in a budget workshop group with some members of some of our sponsors and members of our agency. And it's just very clear that even with the money that we've been able to make in the state of Oregon with this venture, our agency, our expenditures, and the amount of money that we're able to bring in start to almost looks like an alligator's face, if you might think about it. As the time goes on, our revenues continue to go down and our expenditures will stay the same or will increase as expenditures do as time goes on. And so this is getting to be even more important that we at least keep what we have. And if we have to add to do that, then we will have the ability to do that with this amendment.
Okay, and that doesn't even mention the sweep that will be done of any agency that has general fund money in it is going to be sucked out of that agency.
Right, right.
That's correct. Not general funds, other funds.
Other funds. Well, anyway, there is going to be another sweep, and that's something. I don't know if you were impacted by that before, but that's another thing that's coming along.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, we have been impacted by that in the past.
Okay. Well.
Some of our funds are required by bond indentures to be held in reserve for emergencies or foreclosures. But yes, we have been impacted by that in the past.
Okay. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just correct me if I'm wrong, or LFO is, that they're saying that there's only going to be $20,000 more in revenue.
Right.
So we're not talking large dollars here. We're not talking...
No.
Okay.
Senator Morissette, Senator Telford, that's exactly right.
Yes.
Okay. Further...
Nope. We're in work session, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we're in work session. So,
Mr. Chair, I would move the -1 amendment dated February 5th, 2010 to Senate Bill 1005.
Okay. Senator Telfer moves the -1 amendments dated 2510 2, Senate Bill 1005. Discussion? Seeing none. So ordered.
We need to move the bill.
Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1005 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Telfer moves 1005 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
It's Lana Anderson. Yes.
Aye.
Sounds pretty.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator
Winters? Aye.
Vice Chair Telfer?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Okay. The bill passes, and I will carry the bill. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Other business before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned, and we will be back on Thursday.
Committee members?